listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Tonight's program, as you know, is about Ukraine, and my own interest in Ukraine runs deep. My father was born there. It's where my grandmother's stories take place, which I listened to all during my childhood, and I visited and I try to understand its history. But that personal connection doesn't make it any easier for me than it does for anybody else when reading accounts in the media trying to understand the crisis taking place in Ukraine today. In her useful book on Ukraine, journalist Anna Reed reminds us that Ukraina is literally translated as on the edge or borderland. And being a borderland meant two things. Ukraine inherited a legacy of violence with neighbors who refused to see it as a separate country. And second, Ukrainians were left with a tenuous, equivocal sense of national identity. Now, after the Ukrainian Revolution of February 2014 and the impeachment of Ukraine's then president, with Russia's refusal to recognize the new government and its annexation of Crimea, and escalating Russian-Ukrainian hostilities on Ukraine's Eastern Front, we've convened three brilliant thinkers to examine why what happens in Ukraine is of significant international importance, really why we should all care what happens in Ukraine. So our guests tonight are Timothy Snyder, who is the Byrd White Husum Professor of History at Yale University. Tim is the author of 5 award-winning books. His 2010 book, Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, which received the Leipzig Prize for European Understanding, among many others, is a book which, as historian Norman Davies says, forces its readers to rethink history. His forthcoming book this fall, in September, is Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning. And Masha Gessen is a Russian-American journalist and the author of 7 books, including the international bestseller The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and coming out in just 6 weeks, The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. She writes regularly for The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, and many other publications. She was born in Moscow, educated in the U.S., and spent most of her adult life in Russia before emigrating to the United States a few years ago. And Justin Jampol is the founder and executive director of the Vendi Museum, located in my hometown, Culver City. He's our interlocutor tonight. Justin's work focuses on visual cultural studies and the connection between contemporary art and Cold War iconography. He is the author of Beyond the Wall, Art and Artifacts from the GDR, published by Toshin last December. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished guests. Thank you.
Hello. Well, I'm so delighted to see a full house, and I'd be remiss if I didn't start out by thanking the Library Foundation for hosting this fantastic event on a subject that resonates. And if any proof of that is required, all of you here tonight makes the point very loud and clear. So before we begin, I would just like to make a couple of notes about the structure of this that I have in mind. You're dealing with two very experienced speakers here, and I should say I'm incredibly proud and honored to be part of this tonight. They're both remarkable scholars in their field, and it's a pleasure to have the chance tonight to learn a little bit more about their views on a subject that is complicated. And on that note, I'm going to have about an hour of questions for these two, and then after that, we will open it up on the floor and as you just heard, we're going to try to keep it as concise as we can. This could go on forever. We want to make sure that you guys get home in time for supper. So with that said, as a kind of a starting question, Tim, if I can ask you, there has been a deluge of reports, essays, news over the last several months about what's going on here. So what is happening in Ukraine right now? What does Ukraine want, and what are Russia's goals?
Right. No, it's a very.
And you have 5 minutes. No, I mean, you have 5 minutes to answer it all.
You said something about an hour a moment ago. I really like the way you frame the question, because it opens up a contrast which will be very useful for us, I think, as the discussion proceeds, and that is the contrast between what is happening and the deluge of information. I think this may be the historical event in which the ratio of propaganda to actual experience or knowledge is the highest. Even the Second World War, I don't think, was flooded by such competent, technically competent propaganda the way that this event is. So let me try to answer your question by from the beginning, which is, what do Ukrainians want? As we think about war, as we think about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it's very easy for us to lose sight of where this started. Where it started was in a revolution, right? A revolution is a very big event. It's the kind of thing we shouldn't be overlooking. We don't forget about the French one. We don't forget about the industrial one. We don't forget about the American one, right? We're obsessed with it. And here in Ukraine, you had an event which mobilized more than 1 million people, which led to a violent counter-revolution, which changed the state, which was motivated by classical themes, which most people could understand, having to do largely with wanting the rule of law, wanting predictability. The reason why Ukrainians at the end of 2013 were so concerned about the association agreement with the European Union was that they correctly identified it as a way out of corruption, out of unpredictability, into the rule of law. When their government changed its mind and didn't sign that agreement, a protest movement began, which, spurred on by the violence of the regime, eventually became a revolution. So the most fundamental answer to the question of what Ukrainians wanted and want, and this is true actually east and west, north and south, regardless of what language people speak or what their background might happen to be, what they want is competent governance and the rule of law. In other words, the basic thing they want is the thing that all of us take for granted. And before we get into all the exotica of the war and the propaganda, I think that's an important thing to be established. The revolution was made in order to create a government which would be more just, more predictable, and that's what was meant by more European. This was then followed surreally by a Russian invasion, and it's important, and I stress the surreality of it, because we may want to make sense of this. We might want to say, well, there was some reason why Russia invaded Ukraine that had to do with the revolution itself. That's actually quite hard to elucidate. And even the Russian leadership has had a hard time explaining what exactly the relationship is between their decision to invade their neighboring country and the revolution itself. It's not at all straightforward. It's certainly not the case that the revolution itself led to violence. The revolution overturned a government, led to free elections, parliamentary and presidential, and to a pro-reform government. So you have one track of the story, which is revolution, elections, new government. You have another track of the story, which is invasion from a neighboring country. And so then to your question about what Russia wants, I'm sure we'll spend more time about this, but I'll give you the very short version of the answer. There is no positive vision coming from Russia. Usually when a state undertakes a campaign of this kind, there is some positive idea of how things might be better for everyone involved. There is actually nothing like this coming from Moscow. What there is an incredibly clever tactic, which I would think of as strategic relativism. That is, you look for where the opponent is weak, you press on that point, you see how far you can go. And in this way, Russia has been weakening not only the Ukrainian state, but the European Union, the transatlantic relationship. It's been doing all this with a good deal of success. Now, that's a theme that I'm sure we'll develop. And for the first question, I'd like to leave it there.
Right.
Actually, I'll jump in, because I think for once we have a slight disagreement.
No, that's good.
It's a good way to start this off.
I think I don't think the Russian government has had such a difficult time elucidating the direct relationship between the revolution and the invasion. The problem is that it sounds completely insane to people outside of Russia, so you have to bear with me and give me just a little bit of leeway because I'm going to say something that sounds absolutely preposterous. Right? So when the Russian parliament was passing its first resolution on what was then still protests in Ukraine, which was in December of 2013, the chairman of the Duma's Foreign Relations Committee, Alexei Pushkov, said, and we have to understand that if Ukraine moves westward, this will increase the sphere of influence of the gay cultural lobby, which is the official policy of the European Union. Mm-hmm. Now, this is, I think, a really important point, and I use the word preposterous advisedly because I think that there's a paragraph in the last chapter of The Origins of Totalitarianism which I missed like the first five times I read it, and then I finally got it when this happened, where Hannah Arendt talks about the fact that it was very difficult for the West to talk about what was happening in Stalin's Russia and in Hitler's Germany, because it was so absurd, because you couldn't actually articulate the idea that a simple idea could lead to the extermination or of millions of people, because that appeared to a particular leader to be the movement of history, right? That needed to be speeded up by killing off people. It's equally preposterous. It only looks almost rational to us in retrospect, although Tim, I think, is going to overturn all of that in his upcoming book. But something similar is happening with Russia. It is impossible with a straight face to write about what Russians are telling their own people about why they're fighting the war in Ukraine. But there is a logical construction there, and the logical construction is that there is a war of civilizations, that there's the Western civilization, which has its silly idea of universal human rights, which apply to all sorts of people. And if the West wants to live that way, that's, and I'm basically quoting now, right? If the West wants to live that way, that's fine. It can live that way. But it has to stop forcing its Western values down our throats. And what it is doing with Ukraine is using it as a vehicle for forcing these values down our throats, which is where the gay trope comes in very handy, because it's a perfect example of how the West has forced its values down our throats. And so to prevent that, and there's a large traditional value civilization, which is another civilization, which the West is the existence of which the West is ignoring. And in this civilization, only Russia has the courage of its convictions to actually go to war. And the revolution in Ukraine gave Russia a reason to show that it has the courage of its convictions and finally go to war against the expansion of Western civilization.
So if I'm getting this right, you are saying that what's going on now is a continuation of what came beforehand. It led to where we are now. As opposed to, I think, what Tim, are you saying that this is a juncture or it's divergent from what came before?
Okay, good. Maybe I'll take that first and buy Masha some time. Thank you.
That's very chivalrous.
Chivalry is my middle name. Because what I would like to do is now agree with you and disagree with myself. Because there is a way in which it makes sense, and I didn't have the conceptual courage to try to articulate the Baroque in the way that you just did. And what you said is actually, I think, a good answer to Justin's question, because historically there was something that came first. So the story does not begin in the dramatic moment in the end of November 2013 when a Ukrainian journalist, a Russophone Ukrainian journalist of Afghan origin, posts on his Facebook, if you are dissatisfied with this decision not to join the European Union, don't just like my post, come out to the Maidan. That's a very dramatic moment. Another dramatic moment comes a matter of hours after that, when the students who heed that appeal are beaten by Ukrainian riot police. And then other people, Afghan war veterans, Afghans of an entirely different kind, come and support them, and their parents come and support them. That's a dramatic way to tell the story, but it begins earlier. It begins earlier in 2013 when Russian foreign policy for the first time identifies, and I'm going to give a slightly more wonky version of what Masha just said, Russian foreign policy officially identifies the European Union as an adversary, right? Shifting the emphasis of Russian policy from the United States to the European Union and providing an alternative trade zone, which was going to be called the Eurasian Union, where the Eurasian Union was not just a kind of empty economic block of Kazakhstan, Russia, Ukraine, a couple other countries, Belarus, but was also a civilizational alternative. Because the word Eurasia, that notion of Eurasia in Russian, is meant to be a civilizational container of all of the wonderful, profound things which the West is not. So when the protests in Ukraine started, they were greeted not with the cliches that I'm sure we're going to talk about later, which is that it was all the Americans, the CIA, and yada yada, the fascists. Interestingly, that only comes later. What they greet the Maidan with is Swedish pedophilia, gay fascism, right? They say this is the... these are the tentacles of the decadent European Union working their way into the healthy Slavic body and so on and so on. In other words, the first reaction, which I take to be the most authentic one, is this civilizational one, right? And I think that is the prehistory. The prehistory is the decision to try to undo what is now, in effect, European civilization.
And I would say, I would agree with everything that Tim just said, but I would say it began about a year before that.
Yeah, with Bologna.
And actually, we can play this game ad nauseam.
There are only 1,000 years of Russian history.
Right. So right.
A little bit more of Ukrainian history. But in 2012, when Putin came back to power as, well, he'd been in power, but when he reclaimed the presidential chair, which Dmitry Medvedev had kindly kept warm for him for 4 years. He was faced with something that he had never seen that terrified him absolutely, which is mass protests in the streets of Moscow and 99 other Russian cities. And just getting a little bit ahead, I want to say that this is one of those incredibly successful examples of Kremlin propaganda, right? Because we still, in this country, talk about Russian protests. We take it for granted that the Kremlin is right in saying that they were the protests of the urban middle class, the disaffected urban middle class in Moscow. Mm-hmm. Actually, they were nationwide mass protests that were simultaneously happening in 99 different Russian cities. And considering that 80% of Russians live in cities and towns, that's pretty much all of Russia. So he was faced with that. And as a response to that, not only did he engineer a political crackdown, but he reinvented a totalitarian ideology. In fact, I would say he didn't reinvent it, he retrofitted it. The sort of the whole structure of totalitarian ideology that had existed in the Soviet Union had never been dissembled. And what he figured out how to do was sort of slip a new idea into the base, create the new first floor for this structure that set it in motion again. And this new basic idea was this idea of the traditional value civilization, which Russia was leading and guarding.
So you sort of previewed my next question about the significance of this. So what you actually both are saying is that there's so much more at stake here than a geopolitical fight. This is a struggle over culture of civil rights. Am I right in saying that? Basically, the larger question is: we're all gathered here to learn about a conflict, but it seems to me that this particular one resonates with people, and I'm wondering why you think that is.
I'll start. Well, first of all, you can't wage a war if it doesn't resonate with people. I mean, you have to find a good mobilizational strategy. And the Kremlin is very good at that. It also has all the tools at its disposal. It has controlled all broadcast media in the country for 15 years. That's a whole generation of people who've grown up watching only Kremlin television. which the Kremlin itself watches, which also influences the sort of the feedback loop. But what I think is important, you're giving it, I think, in your question, maybe a little bit too much credence by saying, this is a war over civil rights, and I'm not sure.
A cultural struggle. I'm just trying to get at the fact.
I think. If they were a take-home point that I would like to impress on people is that we're sort of primed to look for rational reasons for fighting wars. We're much more comfortable usually with economic explanations and strategic explanations, and those seem very easy to understand. I don't think that that's usually why nations fight wars, and it's certainly not why Russia is fighting its war. It's fighting its war because it's a source of its national identity, and it's fighting its war primarily because that is the source of Putin's power at this point. And that is also the reason why he cannot stop and he can only escalate, because he is now drawing his legitimacy and his power from continuing to keep the nation at war.
Can I take a crack at that? It seems important to stress that even the things which are not at all true can have power. Right. So this idea that Russia represents a healthier version of Western or Christian civilization, that can have power. I mean, even if Putin announces it right when he's divorcing his wife, for example, right, which is sort of the traditional way you inaugurate a family values campaign, is divorce your wife. Even if it's the case that, Ukrainians are much, much more likely to go to church than Russians are, right? Even if it's the case that the actual sexual practices of Russians are at least as, quote unquote, decadent as those in the West, there can be no reality behind the projection, and yet the projection can have a certain amount of power, right? The fact that it's a lie about oneself is irrelevant to its power. It can still draw people in. It can still draw in people in the West, from especially the far right and the far left, who have simple dreams about the way the world works, because this is a simple dream about how the world works. And it can also have power because it's easier to destroy things than it is to break things down, than it is to create things. So I agree with Masha, but it seems to me that we also have to look at how effective things that make no sense are in corroding the things that we value. So this war has been very good, not so much at breaking the Ukrainian state, but at breaking other kinds of relationships. It's made relationships within the European Union much harder. It's stretched the transatlantic relationship. It's challenged the idea of civil society and the propaganda, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more, but the propaganda, by way of its very contradictory nature, right? I think quite consciously makes claims that are not just wrong, not just wrong. I mean, not even wrong, but deeply contradictory. Like, there is no Ukrainian state, but it's repressive. There's no Ukrainian nation, but all Ukrainians are nationalists. There's no Ukrainian language, but the Ukrainian government is forcing people to speak it. the deepest, darkest one, which is we're fighting this war to save the world from fascism, we're getting used to this. It's breaking us down, and that has actually been. It turns out that our minds are a much softer target than the Ukrainian state has been. And the Ukrainian state is not the hardest target in the world. And that, I think, is the fundamental way in which this reaches us all, whether we're in Los Angeles or whether we're in Kyiv.
So it sounds like this is also a war of information in a certain sense. And we talked a little bit about that before. Tim, would you expand a little bit on the way in which the conflict has been, in a certain sense, promoted by Russia? What are we receiving here? How are we receiving that information? And vice versa, how do you think the United States is reflecting back on Russia?
Yeah, I mean, the very word, as I listen to the question, I'm thinking the very word information has itself been changed by this conflict. Like, it used to be a noun, and now it's an adjective. We put it in front of, now it's like, information is an adjective that comes before warfare, right? Because that, I mean, what is actually in information? So, I mean, there are several layers to this. There are several layers to the Russian propaganda. The first is how you describe things that you know you want to do, right? So if you know you want to break a revolution in Ukraine, if you know you want to invade Crimea or the Southeast, how do you describe what you're doing? And at that, there's a kind of worldview propaganda, which says, you know, as I just mentioned, we're saving the world from fascism, right? Or we're resisting the irresistible American hegemon. Some story which then divides public opinion around the world and gives a kind of grandeur, you know, to this actually quite horrible and nasty little war. So when you know what you're doing, you provide a worldview. Then sometimes things happen that you don't expect. Like, for example, you shoot down a civilian airliner, right? The Russians shot down a civilian airliner, killed almost 300 people. When you do that, then there are the tactic is what I think of as calculated cacophony. So you bring in a bunch of people, you know, who have different views about what happened or express different views. So in the case of the Malaysian Airlines fighter, the Malaysian Airlines flight, one version is a Ukrainian fighter plane shot it down, although that was technically impossible. Another version is natural disaster, although that was also extremely unlikely. Another version is that it was the same Malaysian Air flight that disappeared over the Indian Ocean, and that the CIA dredged it up, brought it to Amsterdam, filled it with corpses and a remote control bomb, and then flew it over Ukraine and blew it up to make it look like the Russians had done it. And by the time you hear all of these versions, two things have happened, right? The first thing that's happened is that everyone has forgotten about the actual human tragedy of the loss of life. And the second thing is that everyone's forgotten about Occam's razor, about the simplest possible explanation, which is that the Russians did it, right? So that there's that as a reaction when things go wrong. And then another thing they do very well is political marketing. So for some people, there's the message that the Ukrainian revolution is the work of the world homosexual conspiracy. And then for other people, there's the message that Ukraine is a horrible right-wing intolerant state. For some people, there's the message that Ukraine is a front for the Jewish international conspiracy. For other people, there's the message that Ukraine is a horrible anti-Semitic place, right? And you can keep running these arguments even though they contradict each other. And then that's the fundamental thing, which I've already stressed. Part of what's going on is the deliberate pumping of contradiction, the total, not just unconcern with it, but the deliberate pumping of contradiction into our brains to see what happens to us. And the answer is we're not actually doing very well with it. I mean, like our own postmodern problem is actually their postmodern problem, and they're giving it back to us in a kind of high octane way and seeing how well we can take it. And the answer is so far not very well.
I completely agree with that. I would just add that it's not just to see what happens to our brains, or maybe not so much to see what happens to our brains, but it's to claim the right to say whatever he wants. Oh. It's, you know, he can do whatever he wants, and he can say whatever he wants. And that's a sort of, you know, it's a bully in the playground, and I apologize for that analogy, but it's still the most accurate one, who took a boy's hat. And so he has this hat in his hand, and it's like, what hat? I don't see any hat. It's in your right hand. No, it's not. There's nothing in my right hand. And you can be in that situation forever. And the message is not that he didn't take the hat. The message is that you're never going to be able to speak to him because you're trying to get to locate some sort of rules and some sort of framework in which you can deal with your interlocutor. And he's just continually reasserting his right to say whatever he wants.
So in your book, Man Without a Face, that talks a lot about your point about information / disinformation. Who is to blame for the fact, in your view, that we're only getting this particular story? Is it media that's not doing a very good job of sorting? Are we just buying what they have to sell, or what's going on here? Why do we know what we think we know?
I think they're much better at what they're doing, and they're putting more resources into it than we're at resisting it. And I think that's probably a structural problem. It's sort of the disadvantage of having media that conform to certain standards and of living in a civil society. We continue to search for reasonable and logical narratives. We have to. You know, I had this experience. This is a month and a half ago, even less, right? So we're a year into the war in Ukraine. I wrote a column for the New York Times about this case that's actually a perfect example of what we've been talking about, the Svetlana Davidova case. She is a Russian mother of three, She's a mother of seven who was arrested for supposedly, arrested and charged with high treason. Now, what had happened was that she had been on public transport in her town of Vyazma in Western Russia. She overheard somebody talking about soldiers from the local military base being shipped to fight in Ukraine. This is back in the fall of 2014. And she called the Ukrainian embassy to tell them what she had heard. She is being charged with high treason. She got arrested 7 months later and facing up to 25 years in prison. I wrote a column about it for the New York Times. I mentioned that there's a built-in contradiction there because she is being charged with high treason, but Russia for disclosing information that she was never cleared to have in the first place. She overheard something on public transport. But moreover, not only did she convey a rumor to the Ukrainian embassy, but Russia claims that it doesn't have troops in Ukraine. Right? So how can she have committed high treason by conveying information that Russia claims isn't true? So that's exactly the sort of thing you were talking about. So I get an email message back from the fact checker in the New York Times. It says, we can't find an instance of Russia denying that it has troops in Ukraine. And I couldn't find it either. We finally decided that we could go with it. But we couldn't actually link to a direct statement in which any high-ranking Russian official says there are no Russian troops in Ukraine. At one point they say, there's no proof that there are Russian troops in Ukraine. But they don't say there are no Russian troops in Ukraine.
Right.
That's a very good example, I think, of what makes it so difficult to continue to stick to our own rules and tell a story that's being told with no rules whatsoever on purpose.
Can I have a crack at that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to say something about America and about the Western media and why the structural reasons or structural vulnerabilities. One of them is the centralization of our own media over the last 25 years and the focus on images. This means that we don't actually have spread out all over the world the way we used to foreign correspondents who actually see things with their own eyes and report on them. It also means that we've gotten used to pictures. And if you get used to pictures, then you're very vulnerable to people who are good at putting those pictures in a certain context. And our brains are vulnerable to images in a way they're not vulnerable to words. And a lot of the things that people believe or think they believe about this war come from pictures which are framed in a certain way, which they then can't disgorge, and almost no amount of rational argumentation can then disgorge, right? A picture which is labeled in a certain way. And the converse of this, which I found incredibly interesting and heartening, is that insofar as there are traditional journalists who actually go to the Donbass, go to Ukraine, then you get sensible reports which help leaven, this turbulence that otherwise we're in. I would put this in a more strong way. If it weren't for the fact that there are a few dozen reporters who are actually doing their job in a very traditional way, we'd be hopeless. It's actually just a handful of women and men. I mean, a disproportionate number are actually women, young women, doing this war reporting. If it weren't for them, we would be completely lost. So the whole thing is actually an argument that we should have bailed out. When it was fashionable to bail things out, we should have bailed out print journalism in 2008. Because if we had done that, we could save ourselves billions and billions and billions of dollars, dealing with all of this ridiculous propaganda. The mainstream conservative Western answer to all this has to be send more actual journalists and write and print what they say rather than recycling what comes through the image factory.
Now, Putin seems to be doing quite a lot to project this image of himself. It sounds a very simple question, but is it working insofar as, we now are informed of as you put it, the messages they want us to believe in. But on a domestic sphere, how do Russians see him?
Okay, that's it's actually a more complicated question than you think, because I mean the simple answer to it is it's working beautifully in Russia. It's you know, his popularity ratings, which recovered a little bit after his so-called victory in the 2012 presidential election, really shot through the roof as soon as Russia annexed Crimea, and have basically stayed steady in a way that shows a direct relationship to how steady the war effort has been and the propaganda effort accompanying it. But we have this built-in issue of measuring public opinion in an authoritarian state that's actually reconstituting itself again as a totalitarian state. In a totalitarian country, it's a matter of survival to be able to give the right answer at the right time. And if there is one skill that Homo Sovieticus really, you know, that has been bred into the Homo Sovieticus, which is a term coined by an outstanding Soviet sociologist, it's this skill. It's the skill of holding you know, your ear to the ground and sensing what kind of answer is expected from you, of you. So when we're talking about his popularity shooting up as soon as the mobilization started, we're actually talking about mobilizing public opinion in a very different way, you know, of mobilizing that survival response where people say what they need to say. It doesn't mean they're insincere. It means that this is, again, it's a matter of survival. And giving this response sincerely is also a matter of survival.
Tim, I'm going to take advantage of my position here to ask you questions. And since I run a Cold War museum, how much of this is a Cold War redux, and how much of it is something completely new?
Well, let me put it this way. It doesn't hurt to know something about Soviet history in trying to sort all this out. It doesn't give you everything you need, but it doesn't hurt, for at least two reasons. The first is that the most important human being in this conflict is a product of the Soviet system, and of a particular part of the Soviet system, right? Of the KGB. And so if you know something about the way the KGB works and the way the KGB thinks, some of the things which happen are less surprising. Right, so this business that Masha and I have talked about in different ways, of weakening the opponent, that's classic CK, NKVD, KGB way of seeing and working the world. You're not stronger than your opponent in the obvious way, but what you have is a ruthless ability to see where he's weak and just pull and pull and pull and pull and pull, which is how the KGB or its predecessors broke resistance movements in Eastern Europe or at home. Not by having more money, not necessarily by having more guns, but by being absolutely ruthless in pulling other people's organizations apart. And the worldview which goes with that is the worldview that these organizations are not real. They're not individuals who are choosing to risk their lives in the Warsaw Uprising in 1944 or the Ukrainian Revolution in 2014. They are just the puppets of some distant puppet master in London or Washington or what have you. There's no such thing as civil society. There's not really any such thing as individual human choices. It's all part of some world plot. That's the worldview that goes with it. That worldview and that technique are very much alive today. The second reason why it doesn't hurt to know something about Soviet history is that the leaders of Russia are studying Soviet and Russian history. They're reading now, you know, which is and which is, you know, nice thing to say in a library, right? Like, they're reading books. They have, you know, they've even got a kind of reading circle going in the Kremlin, you know, which I propose they do a little cross-pollination with the suburban housewife reading circles in LA and like see what comes of that. I think it would be really nice for both sides, actually. I think a lot of good would come of that. But in any event, they're reading. They're not reading quite the way I would want them to read, but they're reading. And you see this in Putin's speeches. And some of the things that they're reading have to do with Soviet history. So the stuff that they say about Ukraine, mirrors shockingly the things they said when the Soviet Union invaded Poland in 1939. So the whole business about there is no state, therefore it's okay to go in, that's exactly what they said in 1939. The business of we have ethnic brethren who now need to be protected from statelessness, exactly what they said in 1939. So it doesn't hurt, but there are some things that are different. And I'm sure Masha will have more to say. I'm just going to point to one of these. In the Cold War, the Soviet Union had a project. And you can think what you want of the project. It had a project. I see much less of that now. What I see is more of a corrosive attempt to bring down somebody else's project, which isn't the same thing.
I don't know. I mean, I think that the project can be replaced with a mission. Without making it, I think it may be a distinction without much of a difference for what happens after. And the sense of mission, the civilizational mission, is very well articulated and very well felt by the people in Russia.
Yeah, I think they feel it, but okay, let me put it this way. Mm-hmm. I don't think this one's going to go on for 69 years. I don't think this project, so the Soviet project went on for 69 years, depending on how you're counting. The Cold War went on for 4 decades. I don't think this is going to last that long. I think this is much more mercurial. Part of it is institutional. There's no Communist Party anymore, right? I mean, of the two big institutions that mattered in the Soviet Union, there is a Communist Party, but it's not the party that it once was. There's not a mass party with all that involves. The KGB still exists, one out of two. And their ideology fluctuates. And going back in a way to the previous question, I think that Putin needs to have 80% popularity, right? I don't think the regime is stable the way that a communist regime was stable. I think he needs things which are going to be hard to get, which put him at risk. And I think the war itself is an example of that. This was an extremely risky thing to do from his own point of view. The war in Afghanistan may have brought down the Soviet Union over the course of a couple decades. This could bring down his regime in a much faster time scale. And that way, I don't see it as a kind of Cold War, because I don't think this regime is going to be around for as long.
Well, as a specialist in your field, Tim, in Bloodlands, you explore the history of the region and how things can very quickly and easily spin out of control. Do you see a risk of that here with this particular conflict?
Well, I want to hear what Masha has to say about this, because much of what I think about how it's already spun out of control has to do with Russia itself. I think it's already out of control. I think when you do something which is that popular, you're already losing a kind of genie, because you have to then maintain those levels of popularity. I also think that when you fight a war which you declare to be a lawless war, right? You say we're gonna invade, but we're not gonna wear uniforms. We're gonna invade, but we're not gonna obey the laws of war. We're gonna obey a neighboring state. We're gonna pretend that neighboring state doesn't exist. Right. And when we fight, we're going to enlist all kinds of local brigands and mercenaries. We're going to bring Chechens and others. We're going to fight however way we feel like fighting. And we're going to do that for months and maybe for years. That generates a class of people, Russian citizens, most of them, who then they're not all going to die in Ukraine. Right. I mean, ideally for Putin, they would all go to Ukraine and die, because if they don't, that means they're back inside Russia and inside the political system. And when there is some kind of a crisis, they're going to be on a side and not necessarily his. Right. They may well be on the side of the right wing challenge to Putin. So I think in fighting a lawless war, you're introducing an element of lack of control into your society. And this, may already be evident. Because we'll probably never know exactly what happened in the assassination of Nemtsov, which was, I think, most likely carried out by people who believe they're following the general drift of what the Kremlin wants. And I think it's, I wouldn't be surprised to learn. I mean, we will never learn. But if this or similar crimes would be carried out in the future by people who have fought in the war in Ukraine.
I would add to that in addition to creating this category of people who've been fighting in Ukraine, the Kremlin has actually been creating army of avengers inside Russia, because there's a second war that the Kremlin is fighting inside Russia, which, if you think about it, is absolutely necessary to continue this escalation effort, which is the war on the enemy within, the people that Putin calls the national traitors, the fifth column. And there's a week before Nemtsov was assassinated, the anti-Maidan movement, right? So a movement created for the purpose of rooting out any potential for a repeat of the Ukrainian Revolution in Russia, inside Russia. This movement was marched through the streets of Moscow to the tune of something like 30,000 people, many of them paid, but not all of them. They carried banners, the lead banner said, annihilate the fifth column, right? So these are people marching, and some of them carried banners with Nemtsov's portrait on them. This is a march with calls to violence. Putin is unleashing this force, who have obviously easy access to arms and in any case always can resort to violence, with a sort of blessing to go and engage in violence against people who are perceived as enemies inside the country. So that's one thing that I would add as a hugely dangerous destabilizing factor. And the second thing I would add is that Russia has been, Russia's defense budget has been ballooning over the last 15 years and especially over the last couple of years. And a lot of that is going into drawing up plans, right? And I think we saw a very good example of that with what happened in Crimea, right? Many people were surprised that the Russian military, which is not known for its planning capabilities and for its high level of organization, was able to pull off such a highly organized operation on such short notice. And you know, however you look at it, whether it happened spontaneously in March when Putin originally claimed it did, or in February as he's now saying it did, it was still on very short notice. And the explanation is very simple. There's a whole army, both literally and figuratively, of people who are sitting around doing nothing but drawing up plans that go along with Russia's new military doctrine adopted in December, which strengthened the statement about about NATO countries and the United States being Russia's strategic enemies, and reserves the right of first nuclear strike against any country for any reason. Right? This is in the unclassified part of the military doctrine. We don't know what's in the classified part. So. Add to that the nuclear saber rattling, which has been very consistent for nearly a year. And you see basically an almost inevitable scenario that, and I'm not saying that Putin has a plan, what I'm saying is that Putin has many plans available to him. All of these are plans for escalating the conflict, to continue to maintain a semblance of control, to continue to maintain popularity, to continue to maintain the mobilization of the population, and that means war elsewhere in the region.
To follow up, I want to stay there for just a second. Do you think that, let me take a step back. I had a conversation not long ago with a former U.S. ambassador who made the point that how would the United States feel if Canada and Mexico were part of a Russian allied force. Now, I'm sure you've heard a lot about that. How do you respond to people who say that we've pushed Russia into this corner, into this position?
So Canada is interesting, right? So, I mean, they're going to have a lot of fertile soil, in Austria in the 1930s, they had this for a brief moment in Austria in the 1930s, a brief and ill-considered moment. Their tourist slogan was "Das bessere Deutschland," the better Germany, right? Which sort of came back to haunt them a little bit. And Canada, it's the better America. Yeah. So there's the jokey answer. Now here comes a serious answer. When the very way you phrase the question says something interesting. America, Canada, Mexico are three different sovereign states. When I look at Canada, I don't say, oh, they speak English, therefore they belong to the same ethnicity as me, right? I don't look at them and say, they read Shakespeare, therefore they belong to the same civilization as me, and therefore the sovereignty of that state is somehow questionable, right? I mean, and this is a fundamental difference, because what the Russian position to Ukraine is not, this is a sovereign state that can make decisions whether it joins NATO or not joins NATO, whether it joins the Eurasian Union or joins the European Union. That would be one conversation. The Russian position is, this is not really a sovereign state. The sovereignty itself is blurred There are various versions of this. One is that the Maidan itself ended sovereignty. Another is that nationality. Another is ethnicity. Another is civilization. And I think it's important to realize that in that way, the whole question is posed, you know, in a way which isn't actually applicable. Because whatever our current sins are, and I'm happy to talk about them, one of them is not to say that Canadians belong to the American ethnicity. And therefore, they don't exist, right? I mean, we're pretty far away from that. So the other answer, and this is, I think, very important. This didn't, and I'm so glad you began the conversation the way you did for this reason. This is not about the United States wanting to expand NATO. This is not about the European Union wanting to enlarge. The European Union never wants to enlarge. It's always forced upon them by people in border states who see the advantages of being inside this community. The European Union does not have a policy of enlargement. It has the capacity to enlarge. And when we ask the question this way, like, how would the Russians feel? How would the Americans feel? We're overlooking the basic fact of how this started. This started because most Ukrainians thought it would make sense for themselves to join the European Union. So in that sense, like, I just don't care. Like, personally, in terms, like, ethically, in terms of the ethics of our politics, it should matter much more to us that people want to live free and predictable lives in a rule of law state than, you know, whatever scenarios diplomats can spin out about how you would feel if you were playing Risk in the world, right? Mm. That's basically how I see this.
What about you, Masha?
What he said.
Good, let's move on. No,
but kidding. Actually, no, I think that NATO has done many things terribly wrong in handling its relationship to Russia in the last 20 years, and I've written about some of them. That has very little to do with the fact that there's a country called Ukraine where almost 50 million people made it through great pain and effort and bloodshed and made it very, very clear,
yep, you
know, where they want to be. But I also want to pick up on your point about the ethics of our politics, or even I would say the morals of our politics. I think that this conversation is terribly important because part of what we're talking about is that, or part of the message that I think is emerging is that there's no strategic way to stop Putin. And one of the fallacies that have been at the root of all the political conversations about this is what can we is the idea that there's something that we can do through sanctions, through arming Ukraine, through not arming Ukraine, through pacifying Russia, that will change the course on which Putin has set Russia. That is not the case. So there's no room for strategic thinking in relationship to Putin. There's only room for a kind of moral politics in relationship to Putin and in relationship to Ukraine.
Well, I have two more questions, and then we are going to let you have a crack at them. But the first one is just sort of to slowly but surely wrap this up, is, was this after the fall of the USSR? Was there a moment that, and Masha, we can start with you, is there a moment in the 90s, perhaps, that you thought it could have gone a different way, and that was the juncture at which it all changed and it went down the path that it's on now?
Yes. I think there are probably three moments.
Okay.
So one moment is 1991. There is a hardline coup against Gorbachev. Eight hardliners, including the top brass in the KGB, place Gorbachev under house arrest, declare a state of emergency in Russia, and after 3 days, almost miraculously, fold. The coup is over, the Soviet Union is over, and they're all in jail. And then they're amnestied. And I think this was really, this was the first breaking point. This was this idea that that you can amnesty people who arrested the president, who declared martial law, who declared every value that is antithetical to the values that you're supposedly about to start building a new country on. You can amnesty them for the sake of not stirring up conflict in the country. So same thing happened with the case against the Communist Party. After the coup, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was banned, which was kind of irrelevant because the Communist Party of Russia wasn't, and the Soviet Union was no more very soon. The prosecutor's office worked on assembling a case against the Communist Party, and the idea was that the Communist Party was going to be prosecuted in the public court, and this was going to start the new era. And then they decided not to go ahead with it. The case against the Communist Party is 80 volumes of documents, two copies of which exist, as far as I know, that have never been published, that have never become the subject of public discussion, for fear that it would stir up conflict and create a witch hunt. And the third moment is 1993, basically a parliamentary crisis in Russia that was largely precipitated by Yeltsin's decree. He grew terribly frustrated with a semi-democratically elected parliament that was impossible to work with and decided to basically declare presidential rule. The parliament rebelled, and Yeltsin ordered the shelling of parliament. And this basically, these three events combined to say, you know, there will be no break with Soviet history. And when push comes to shove, conflicts will be resolved through armed struggle.
The wide view lens, Tim.
Okay, I'll give you wide. I think the moment when history failed to turn was probably 1928, the beginning of Stalin's first 5-year plan. I'm actually kind of serious about this because the decision that socialism in the Soviet Union would take the form of tremendously centralized enterprises at the expense not only of smaller enterprises but of agriculture carried out, which could theoretically have been by small farmers on small plots. The decision by the state to take over agriculture and to concentrate industry to create a kind of hypertrophied version of American economic development as the model, that decision means that when the Soviet Union comes to an end, it's very easy for wealth to concentrate in a few hands, as it does in Russia and in Ukraine. And Russia and Ukraine are different versions of how you resolve this problem. In Russia, you get one mega oligarch who manages to control all the other oligarchs. And in Ukraine, you get a failure to do that, right? So you, in both cases, you start out with a kind of oligarchical pluralism. And in Russia, that gets centralized. And in Ukraine, it doesn't. And in the struggle in Ukraine is, to go back to the beginning, is to get from oligarchical pluralism to real pluralism, right? And which can be done. The history of the United States shows that it can be done. It can be done. The second point a turning point is much more recent. I think it's in 2012 or 13. This idea, which now seems so natural to us because it seems so natural to Russia's leaders, that Russia had to turn away from Europe because Europe is gay, fascist, gay, etc. Like, that's all normal now because it's happened, but it's deeply strange. Right? It is deeply, going back to Masha's very first point, it's deeply strange for a country whose history is so European, whose concepts are European, whose language is impregnated with European concepts that are familiar to, you know, everyone who speaks whatever it might be, Spanish to Polish. It's very strange for a country that trades mostly with Europe. It's very strange for a country whose people like to travel to Europe, whose references are European, whose literature is European. It's very strange to make this kind of turn, not just away from Europe, but towards China, just to drop a big bomb at the end of the discussion. It's an odd thing to have happened, and at a certain point, someone is going to realize that none of this makes sense. So, I mean, as I see it, Ukraine was a huge mistake for Russia. That it makes much more sense on all of these levels, from like tourism to economics, for Russia to also have, in parallel to the much smaller and less important country Ukraine, in parallel with Ukraine, to also have a close economic and political relationship with Europe. And the choice to fight with Europe over Ukraine was a choice. It didn't have to be made, and I think it was a disastrous choice. And if we're still talking about this in 15 years, I think we'll be talking about the attempt that Russians will then be making to reverse that choice.
So as my final question, and that's a perfect way to transition into this question. If I could ask you both to look into your crystal balls and tell me, or tell all of us here so we can get you on the record, where do things go from here? What is the end game? If you can just briefly point out for us, what are the basic ways that this could go?
I have made one horribly wrong prediction in my life. So when I thought that the Russian protests of 2011, 2012 were actually going to bring Putin down. So I'm very wary of making predictions ever since then, because I actually published it, in a book. But I think what I feel safe saying is that what's going on now is so poisonous and so destructive to the very fabric of society, or what remains of society in Russia, that the longer it goes on, every month that it goes on, pretends a worse future for Russia when it's finally over. I don't think it's going to take a generation for this to end. I think it will probably take years. But I don't think it will end peacefully. I don't think it will end well. And I don't think it will end with Russia in its current, as a federation in its current borders.
Okay. So two things. I'm in a worse position than Masha because I made some correct predictions. I predicted that Russia would invade Ukraine at a time when everyone thought that was madness, and I really had to fight with the editors of the New York Times to get it in as strong a version as I wanted it. I actually wanted it in a much stronger version. I predicted that they would rehabilitate the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which may seem like an obscure thing, but it's actually rather significant. And having made a couple of correct predictions, I feel like I should stop.
Right? Stop while you're on top.
So here comes my sophisticated dodge. Two things. The first is that this is a kind of prediction. This will not end in Ukraine, because it's not fundamentally about Ukraine. It never really was. It's about Russia's turn towards or against something called Europe. It's going to end with, as I see it, it's going to end with the European Union falling apart. It's going to end with some kind of regime change in Russia. It's going to end in some way that we can't predict. And I agree with Masha, we can't entirely control. But it's not going to end in Ukraine. There are things we should do with Ukraine. We should try to be supporting the Ukrainian state as part of supporting the Western order. Those are things we should do. But what we shouldn't imagine is that either selling arms or having a peace treaty is going to end this. It cannot be ended in Ukraine just because it's not about Ukraine. And what that means, and this is the last thing I want to say, is that when we think about this conflict, we have to not be trying to think about how we're going to corner Putin and get him out of power, because we can't do it. If we try to do it directly, it'll probably be counterproductive. It's very unpredictable, right? What we need to do is, at the level of ethics, economics, politics, decide who we are. That's what this is fundamentally about, because when it does come to an end, it will matter what we have done. As the United States, as Europe, as the West, it will then matter what we have done to define ourselves. We'll be in a position, better or worse, to face it when it comes to an end. Because this conflict is going to, if the Putin regime falls, the conflict is still going to be there, right? It's still going to be there in some form. So what we can do has to do with rebuilding ourselves. And I think fundamentally that's what this is. I mean, the only way to read this positively at all is that this is a kind of challenge, right? And a challenge is an opportunity.
Everyone, Tim Snyder and Masha Gessen. Well, first, first and foremost want to not only thank our guests, but again, I want to thank the Library Foundation for their support of the project, for producing this special event. I encourage all of you to get involved with it, if only because these are fantastic mugs that the foundation produces. So I've been not only eyeing it all night, but drinking from it, and it's fantastic. But really, this was a very special event. I thought the answers were very deep and probing, and I look forward to getting your questions. Now, one thing I do want to point out, that I ask you to keep it to a brief question. We don't have that much time, and I'm going to do something that my instructors used to say to me, or do to me all the time, because you see how much I talk, which is that if it goes on a little too long, I'll just raise my hand, and that's just to encourage you to wrap it up.
First question, right over here.
Thank you so much. And this question is for both Masha and Professor Snyder. All my friends in the Baltics are scared to death of the current situation. How likely is it for Putin to continue this aggression by invading Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania? And how would you think NATO would respond if they actually dare to do that? Because so many Americans don't think that it's worth it, you know, to risk their lives for the Baltics. But it's so important.
If I lived in the Baltics, I'd be scared. I think that the Baltics have great rhetorical potential for Putin. When he needs to invade another country, a country like Kazakhstan is not going to be probably very successful in mobilizing the population. But it's very easy to claim that Latvians are fascist collaborators, probably also homosexuals, and Russia needs to protect itself by fighting in Latvia. Now, if our recent history is any guide, and I think it is, I'm afraid it is, it will be similar to Ukraine in the sense that yes, these are NATO countries, but it will probably begin with some sort of dubious hybrid warfare effort where there is a rebel faction somewhere in a primarily Russian-speaking town in Latvia or Estonia, and Russia will claim that it's not there, and this will fester and result in many lost lives before we see a real response from NATO, if we see one.
Yeah, not much to add to that. I would be scared too. I think in an odd way, though, the success that Russia has had inside the European Union, which is a subject that I raised, we didn't talk much about, that suggests to me they're going to keep pushing in those directions. They've got an awful lot out of French nationalism. They've got an awful lot out of the German left. They've got very close ties now to a number of important parties in the Balkans. If I were them, assuming, of course, that there's still central control over all this, I would push on those things for a while and try to hollow out NATO from within before I did the terrible things that Masha's talking about.
I'd like to kind of create an alternate universe with my question. You had the first question was, you know, what is going on in the Ukraine and what is in it for Russia, I believe. What is in it for the United States? Obviously, we invested up to about $20 million a week in supporting opposition in the Ukraine. What's at stake for the U.S.? What's our dog in the fight?
We don't have a dog in the fight. I mean, I don't know where the figure $20 million a week for the opposition comes from. The problem with opposition, you know, is that opposition is normal, right? Opposition's normal. If there's a government, it's going to have some opposition. And the way things went wrong in Ukraine is not that, you know, I or, you know, Justin or you or any other American went and paid people to protest. The problem with Ukraine was that something which was authentically serious for a majority of the population, that is the rule of law, was not met by their own government, right? Now, if you know, if you or I vote Republican or vote Democrat in the coming elections because we truly care about the Keystone Pipeline, let's say, we could say that that's because we were paid off by Russia, right? There are Russian lobbying groups that oppose the Keystone Pipeline, but right. I'm happy to handle that too. Although I generally think that one question a person would be about, right? But there is like, I'm just trying to, you know, just to create a kind of parallel here so we understand. Russia has an interest in the Keystone Pipeline not happening. I also have an interest in it not happening. I don't like earthquakes. But that doesn't mean, right, that I'm a Russian puppet. Opposition is normal. And opinion polls carried out by Ukrainian, Russian, and all other agencies showed that European Union membership in Ukraine was popular. The people who went out on the street and stayed there for months in the cold, which we wouldn't do, which unfortunately Russians don't do, those people who went out and stayed in the freezing cold, which we wouldn't do for a night, frankly, I doubt there are very many people here who do it for a night, for months, who then risked death and in many cases were killed, they were doing it not because, you know, I was giving them a few dollars a day or you were. They were doing it because they actually cared about the lives of themselves and of the coming generations. When the students were beaten on the Maidan, as they were, and when the war veterans came to protect them, and they spoke of protecting our children, they were speaking of the future of Ukraine. They were not speaking of some effort to do what, you know, Victoria Nuland said. As for the conversation, I'm happy you mentioned that, because it's a really beautiful example of propaganda and how it pays to spend a little time to think about what's going on. The conversation between Ambassador Pyatt and Victoria Nuland in January of 2014 was about their attempt, their failed attempt, to persuade the Ukrainian opposition to make a deal with the existing president and join a government in which he was still in power. In other words, that conversation is about American diplomats trying to talk the Ukrainian revolutionaries down and failing to do so. In other words, its actual content is totally the opposite of the spin that was put on it when it was released out of context later on. As for our dog in the fight, you know, there was no one who wanted to have a fight. The significance of this event is not geopolitical. The significance of this event is about what tens of millions of people wish for themselves.
I was interested in your comment about the rule of law in the Ukraine now. It seems to me, and I'm not a historian, but that since the Soviet Union broke up, that the governments in the Ukraine have been scandalous. And so I'm wondering why now and why not 10 years ago or 5 years ago?
Yeah. As for the description of Ukrainian governments as scandalous, I think that's spot on, and you don't have to be a historian or not a historian to see that. It's a common problem, right, with the end of the Soviet Union, because these weren't, I mean, grosso modo, the Soviet Union was not actually a state in a traditional sense. It was a party system in which the party, and therefore ultimately individual human beings, had priority over the state and its predictable conventions of administration and law. And building rule of law from nothing, you know, turns out to be a hard problem. Right. No one in the Soviet Union has actually done such a good job of it. The exceptions would be places that have only been under Soviet rule for a couple of generations. The Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians have done a decent job. But in general, if you were in the Soviet Union when it was founded in 1922, you're having a hard time with the rule of law. And interestingly, no territory which was in the Soviet Union was established in 1922 is now in the European Union. Right. There's something in what you say. Now, that it took so long, I think it took a while for people to focus on this as the central issue, right? I mean, when there was a protest movement in Ukraine in 2004, it was about democratic elections. It was about the failure to count ballots, which is something that we can appreciate. You know, their ballots weren't counted. They protested. Our ballots weren't counted. I don't know. We watched TV about it, but it's a common issue, right? It happened at the same time, interestingly enough. Their exit poll showed a different result. They went on the street. Our showed a different result. We I don't know, what did we do? I don't remember. We didn't do much. But at that time, you know, at that time in 2004, the thought was, okay, if we just get the right guy, you know, in, then everything will be fine. And I think there was some political learning between 2004 and 2014, because the guy who was elected got in, but basically nothing changed because he was from the same kinds of milieu. And honestly, even in the current situation, they've taken baby steps forward. They've reformed higher education. They've done some things that matter, but they've got an awful long way to go. Part of the tragedy of the current war is that the war gives an excuse not to carry out some of the more important domestic reforms. And then if I go back to being, you know, I'll go back to my Marxist analysis of the whole thing. The war actually enables a kind of counter-revolution, because when someone invades you, not only does that mobilize nationalist sentiment, but it also means that you got to fight the war with the powers that you've got. It's very hard to challenge them because they're all you've got right now at a moment of you know, survival or extinction.
Do you see the war as an attempt to divert attention from the kleptocracy, as you call it in your book, the amount of theft that's going on by Putin and his cronies? Does the war divert people from thinking about that?
I actually don't call it a kleptocracy in my book because I don't think that's exactly accurate. But that's Karen Dawisha's excellent book, but she uses that term. I think that sort of misframes the what's happened a little bit. Certainly, the failing economy in Russia, and this is the thing: the economic slowdown in Russia began long before sanctions and before falling oil prices. The sanctions and the falling oil prices certainly speeded the process along. But what was really at the root of the economic, the disastrous economic slowdown in Russia in 2012, 2013, especially 2013, was the corruption. Was there the total failure to reinvest in the country and the, just the endemic siphoning of all resources. And the fact that corruption is essential to the functioning of the system. So, and because corruption is essential to the functioning of the system, it's very difficult to say that this is that the system is doing something to try to distract attention from itself. No, not exactly. It's putting its corruption to work on a different focus to distract the population, yes, in part, from the failing economy, which is a result of corruption.
Can I have a two-finger on that? Because I think this is really, really, really important, because it brings us back to what some of the basic issues of the conflict. I mean, I agree with Masha that there's not an active attempt to distract. That would be that's in a way too delicate. It's more that in both Russia and Ukraine, the fundamental problem is corruption. That's the fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem for the current Russian leadership about the protest movement in Ukraine is not that it's, you know, not that it's any of the things that they say. The fundamental problem is that it's about the rule of law, right? Or if you press the point a little bit harder, it's about Russian-speaking people in a big post-Soviet capital protesting for the rule of law. Because the rule of law, there are many things this regime can withstand, but the rule of law is not one of those things. And if Ukraine actually succeeds, going back to this important question, in becoming less of an oligarchical state and more of a functioning rule of law state, that's not bad news for Russia. That's great news for Russia, but it's bad news for the people who currently rule Russia.
We have time for two more questions, if I can ask you to keep it brief. And after this, after the questions are done, before you leave, make sure to buy their books, which are fantastic books, and they'll be there on hand to sign the books for you. So this is a very special treat. I encourage you to take them up on that offer.
So I want to put you both on the spot. If you were at the highest level in the State Department, what would you recommend the president do to counterbalance what's occurring?
I wouldn't want the president to tell me how to write books or articles. So I think I would rather do my job, which is criticize, and let other people do the recommending. But I think that at this point, judging from the public statements that are coming from the president and from the State Department, there is a basic lack of understanding of what is happening in Russia and what is driving the conflict, which is what we've been talking about for the last hour and a half.
Yeah, so I'll be a little less, a tiny bit less shy. Part of the problem with all this is the Americans and the Europeans have nice stories about how things have to go our way. The European story is that we're peaceful, we're nice, we don't like war. You know, why would anyone not like us? And at a certain point, you know, at a certain point in history, you gain adversaries, fairly or unfairly, right? Probably unfairly, but it's just a fact now that Russia is trying to make the European Union come apart, and it's taken them a while to realize that. That said, I think it's sinking in faster in Europe than it is here. Our happy story, which we told as soon as Russia invaded Ukraine, we started telling this happy story, like punching a button. Our happy story is globalization, economics, this is irrational, therefore it's not happening, right? That's what we tell ourselves. Like, this doesn't make any sense, you know? This doesn't make any sense. So it's there. Why are they doing it? It's not really happening. Or if it is happening, it can't last for long because somehow the forces of globalization, yada, 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 right? And of course, that is just not true, right? I mean, the 1920s and 1930s tell an entirely different story. People can make decisions in the short term which throw off all of the beautiful long-term trends that you're counting on and expecting because you want a peaceful retirement or whatever. So the American story has taken a long time to die, you know, the kind of happy story about how, because, you know, free markets work, yada, yada. And what we have to realize is that there are people who precisely understand our story, who understand the European story, who can get inside our story, who can use our story against us. And this isn't a matter for the president. It's a matter for everyone who consider themselves to be taking part in some kind of society or civilization. How do you think about what's happening? Because ultimately, if we lose this, it's going to be because we don't think. We buy into contradictions. We lazily allow ourselves, our emotions to be appealed to, right? And we don't see what's happening before our eyes. MH17 is a good example of this, right? I went through MH17 in the context of Russian propaganda, but let's think about what MH17 means for the West and our own problems. Why did MH17 go down? The short answer is it went down because a Russian tank battalion armed with anti-aircraft missiles shot it down. Long answer is... we, the West, knew in last summer that Russia had invaded Ukraine. If Russia invades Ukraine, that means Russian tanks are in Ukraine. If Russian tanks are in Ukraine, that means anti-aircraft capabilities in Ukraine. The anti-aircraft capability does not have the, and we knew all this, cannot distinguish between anything except Russian jets and everything else, right? So logically, when that plane was shot down, we knew everything we needed to know to reroute civilian air traffic. Why didn't we? Because we couldn't use our mouths to pronounce the things that our minds knew, that Russia had invaded Ukraine. And in that sense, we are co-responsible for that accident. In that sense, in a limited sense. And I just make that point to say that in some sense, we are co-responsible for tragedies that unfold because we refuse to see what's actually happening. That's what we can do. I mean, as for the president, if I were telling the president what to do, I would say this is an opportunity to announce doctrine, right? Because we're not going to win strategically. We're not going to win by getting Putin into some kind of corner. But this is an opportunity to say what it is that we actually stand for. And I would suggest that one of the things we stand for is the preservation of traditional sovereignty with the possibility of supranational cooperation as and when those sovereign states wish to take part in it, which is a very conservative description of the international order, but one which I think is worth, you know, is worth endorsing. But yeah, there you go.
Well, last question.
What is your opinion of Russian general population? Should they be held responsible for so eagerly consuming Kremlin's propaganda and making this big evil out of the ordinary KGB officer? And do they have blood on their hands? Not Kremlin, but population.
Oh, that's a difficult question. I've never really thought of it that way. But let me try it. I mean, as a Russian citizen, I absolutely feel responsible and ashamed for what has happened, what Russia has done, in my name among other people. Even though I'm forced to live in exile, but but still it's being done in my name because I carry a Russian passport. Russians have voted for Putin in beginning with elections that were quasi-believable. Russians have failed to pay attention to things that have happened in plain sight, such as political murder, such as the closure of independent media, such as the arrests of peaceful protesters. So, yeah, absolutely. That makes the population as a whole culpable. Does it make every individual culpable? That's where it gets very tricky, because how much can we ask people to do? I mean, again, I left to protect my family, and so obviously I didn't stay to fight. I think that the risks of even going out in the street to protest at this point are potentially deathly. In fact, I don't think that. We see that. That's what happened last week. So the amount of risk that we would ask any single Russian citizen to take at this point to oppose Russia's war in Ukraine or Putin's policies is simply more than you can reasonably ask of a human being.
Well, I want to thank all of you again for coming here tonight and to the foundation for all the support.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.